But across out every culture, they would have a character or characters where they could relate to them and they are their role models. Why? Because they stood for a core principle or a value. And then, you know, people start to look at that person and try to celebrate his life. And, you know, some of these characters turn into religions. They turn into gods like Confucianism or like Buddhism. They turn into gods because of their core values. When we look at the Ahl al-Bayt alayhim salam, and specifically Ali al-Akbar alayhi salam, because he's a role model for the youth, first, we have to see what Ali al-Akbar alayhi salam stood for. What is his core value in life that I and you could relate to? And then we look at his actions. What did he do as a human being, as a person in his life that I can do as well? And with the Ahl al-Bayt alayhim salam and the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, all the prophets, the beauty about them, they don't have anything attached to them in the sense that segregated them from the rest of the world. Oh, he's just my imam. He's only for the Shia, he's only for the Muslim. No one could relate to him.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
What makes a role model a role model is what he stands for. But when we look at Amir al-Mu'mineen, if I take him as an example, the justice of Ali alayhi salam was applied to everyone during his time when he was the Khalifa of his time. Whether you're a Christian or you're a Jew, you're old or young, everyone got their right equally. When Talha and Zubair came to him, one wanted Basra and one wanted Kufa to be governor. She said to him, based on what? Oh, those who said, I want extra money because I am Qurayshi, how could you equalize me to a Persian? Amir said, last time I checked, everybody was from earth and Adam was from dust. Mm-hmm. So why should I? So the justice here was applied to every human being. When people come to the Ahl al-Bayt, they come to them as mutual characters to the entire earth. Any human being would relate to them. Anyone that comes in contact with them, they will get something from them. Even, you know, they have been blessed to have the languages of all languages that mankind deal with. So the Imam would speak, a person comes to Imam Sadiq from Persia, he wanted to speak with the Imam in Arabic. The Imam preceded him by speaking with him in Persian. Mm-hmm. Just to, you know, tell him, like, I know
cool,
what you're saying.
Man.
Yeah, so,
okay.
You know, you don't have to trouble yourself. Mm-hmm. So they could relate to everyone. So their character, sometimes we have characters, when you look at them, they are limited to a space and time. You can't take them out. He can't give them to the entire world to deal with. So, for example, for those who take Mussolini as a role model, which a lot of people do, so on the Soviet Union, for example, and all Italy and all these countries, they would take bloodbaths as role models, or those who take Hitler as a role model in Germany. I can't use Hitler as a role model to a time and space, and what he did was bad. With Ahl al-Bayt alayhi salam, and especially Ali al-Akbar alayhi salam, for the youth, if I tell the story of Ali al-Akbar to anyone, mm-hmm. Muslim or non-Muslim, they will get moved by it.
They'll celebrate him as a value.
Exactly. They will see that these values are not something limited to a Muslim. So when we see
Imam, and they're not relative.
Exactly. So I always say this. For example, when you look at Karbala, we say it's a university, right? It truly is. In terms of racism, did Imam al-Hussein differentiate between his black fighters and his
brothers?
No, actually, on the contrary, he comes to the slave, he puts his cheek on his cheek, mm-hmm. and he would recite something. He goes to his Ali al-Akbar and he would do the exact same thing. So he did not differentiate. So racism did not exist. Racism is something that me and you are suffering with today in the 21st century, and we're still having that racism problem. Mm-hmm. So in any way I look at the Ahl al-Bayt alayhim salam and Ali al-Akbar alayhi salam specifically because we are celebrating his birthday and he's a role model to youth. Any human being, any youth, if they put the effort into looking into his life, they would gain and come up with something that mm-hmm. they could use in their own life.
The This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can listen to us at parstoday.com/en.
Another question that I have, Sayyidina, is that, well, you know, the thing about Ali al-Akbar is that the highlight, really, the climax of his achievements was in Karbala, right? Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like a narrow field for us to explore, you know? It's literally just a battlefield. And I'm wondering whether there are things that he did or said during the Battle of Karbala that we can take as life lessons, or are there things, events that took place prior to Karbala throughout the course of Ali al-Akbar's life that we can, you know, connect with and sort of apply into our own lives?
Well, any person or any human being, at the end of the day, when the end or their life comes to end, is that we see that they live to the core values that they adhere to during their life. Or was it the end different? A lot of people, they have a moral code when they do things in life, but once, you know, as they get close to their death, they change and they deviate and they do things opposite to the things that they were preaching themselves. Mm-hmm. With Ali al-Akbar alayhi salam, when he ended his life, what did he end it with? Did he stood up to the values that he lived by all his life or not? And we can see that in Karbala, Ali al-Akbar alayhi salam, he presented himself in a way where it's simple, if we look at it, even though it was a very short battle, mm-hmm, and ended very quickly. But Ali al-Akbar alayhi salam stood for many things. Amongst the things that we can relate to today, he stood against oppression and against slavery and against people, their minds being overtaken and people being brainwashed. And all these things that Yazid and his army were trying to push into people, which is something that we live today. We're under the subconsciously, we are under the control of the media or under Hollywood or those who are oppressors or governments. These were the exact same things that Yazid was doing in his time. Ali al-Akbar, in the battlefield, he stood against these things, which is, you know, we can relate to today. When he fought and gave his life, whether he said something or not, just him saying, "I will not accept oppression. I will not accept anyone depriving me my free will and the free of thought and the free to live as a free person. I will not stand to that. I will fight for it until the last drop of blood I have." So that's something that Ali al-Akbar alayhi salam lived for. He fought for that cause. He fought for the freedom of mankind. It doesn't matter what the faith is. If you want, you know, like how Gandhi said, "I learned from Hussein to be an oppressed and succeed."
Victorious,
he looked, yeah, at him from that aspect. You know, he looked at him from an aspect that, you know, he fought oppression, not he fought Yazid, who's against his grandfather. Mm-hmm. He did not look at it as a religious thing. Rather, he looked at it as a value for humanity. Mm-hmm. Ali al-Akbar alayhi salam, he stood there. In terms of faith, he fought for his faith. In terms of his imamah, he fought for the imam of his time. He had to give up his life for the imam of his time, which is his father. In terms of saving, Islam, he did his part. In terms of saving the core values of humanity, be it freedom, be it justice, be it equality, be it fairness, all these things, Ali al-Akbar alayhi salam fought for. And that's why when we celebrate his birthday or his martyrdom, these are the concepts that we are celebrating in reality. Whether it's him, his father, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, or all the brave heroes who fell in Karbala, they fought for these concepts.
Mm-hmm. So they basically fought for every single value available during their time and those that would prevail the tests of time and become universal. Of course, there's so much more to say about this. Thanks for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because of you. In weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love.
The fast-moving variant poses new puzzles in viral transmission, severity, and evolution, says Amber Dance, writer, in an article titled "Omicron's Lasting Mysteries: Four Questions Scientists Are Racing to Answer." Stay tuned for more. Infection rates with the Omicron variant of the coronavirus SARS-CoV-2 are plummeting in many countries around the world, but scientists are still struggling to understand how it spreads so rapidly and what it might do next, especially because the subvariant known as BA2 is rising in some places. Unlike previous variants of concern, Omicron often infects people who possess antibodies against earlier SARS-CoV-2 versions, acquired through infection or vaccination. In the 3 months that scientists have been aware of Omicron, they have learned a lot, but most work so far has focused on the parent Omicron strain or on BA1. Researchers still have a number of pressing questions. In people, Omicron seems to be highly contagious, BA2 even more so than BA1, but to cause less severe disease than other variants. How does it manage that? Studies on this and on how the variant interacts with host cells and immune systems could lead to better medicines or improved vaccines, and lab experiments that put artificial pressures on the virus to see what mutations arise offer hints about what variants might appear as SARS-CoV-2 continues to evolve. The virus has changed, says Salim Abdulkarim, an epidemiologist at the Center for the AIDS Program of Research in South Africa in Durban, adding, "It enters cells differently. It infects lungs differently. It infects the nose differently." Here, the Nature highlights some of the key questions for scientists to tackle about Omicron and what might come next. Much of Omicron's success must come down to the dozens of mutations that separate it from previous variants and enable it to evade host antibodies, particularly the neutralizing ones that bind to the virus's outer spike protein and block cell entry. That means that despite widespread immunity to earlier SARS-CoV-2 versions, there are more available hosts for Omicron to hop between compared with when the Delta variant was dominant. But there might also be something inherent in Omicron's biology that makes it highly transmissible regardless of human immunity, This could be a change to how a person infected with the coronavirus transmits it, how another receives it, or both. On the transmission side, one idea is that this variant creates a higher concentration of viral particles in the nose, so that infected individuals release more coronavirus with every exhalation. Data on this point have been mixed. One result in favor of this hypothesis comes from a study of human lung and bronchial tissues led by Michael Chen, a virologist at the University of Hong Kong. The data suggests that Omicron replicates faster in the upper respiratory system than all previous forms of the virus. Researchers led by the Wendy Barclay, a virologist at Imperial College London, observed that Omicron replicates faster than Delta in cultures of nose cells. But some studies reported that immunologically naive hamsters had fewer virus particles, none of which were infectious, in their lungs compared with previous variants. Other studies in people indicate that Omicron produces the same or lower levels of infectious viral particles as Delta does in upper respiratory tracts. As for the potential receivers of those infectious particles, Barclay suggests that Omicron's transmission strength might be linked to how it enters cells. Earlier versions of SARS-CoV-2 relied on a cellular receptor, ACE2, to bind to the cells, and on a cellular enzyme called TMPRSS2 to cleave its spike protein, granting the virus entry. Omicron has mostly abandoned the TMPRSS2 route. Instead, cells swallow it whole and it lands in intracellular bubbles called endosomes. Many cells in the nose make ACE2 but not TMPRSS2, Barclay says. That could give Omicron an edge as soon as it's inhaled, allowing it to set up shop without reaching the lungs and other organs where TMPRSS2 is more widely expressed. This could in part explain why Omicron can pass so easily between people and how it so rapidly establishes infections. Hospitalization and death rates for Omicron compared with those from previous variants seem to suggest that it is a weaker strain. But because many people have some level of immunity through COVID-19 vaccination or previous infection, it's challenging to untangle how much of that reduced severity stems from people's immune systems being preconditioned to take on the virus, and how much from some inherent feature of the virus itself. It's much more difficult to have a clean genetic and immunological study, says Jean-Laurent Casanova, a pediatric immunologist at the Rockefeller University in New York City. Scientists at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine in Cleveland, Ohio, attempt to control for these factors by looking at first-time COVID-19 cases in children younger than 5 years old who are not yet eligible for vaccination. Omicron infections were less severe than Delta cases in terms of rates of emergency department visits, admissions to hospital or intensive care units, and need for mechanical ventilation. In another study, researchers in South Africa analyzed hospitalization and death risk for infected adults during the Omicron wave and during earlier surges, adjusting their data to account for previous infections, vaccination, and other factors. They estimated that 25% of Omicron's reduced risk of severe disease or death was due to something intrinsic to the virus itself. The overall Omicron data so far suggests to Berkeley that Omicron could be highly contagious early on in the infection because it starts out so strong. But it's possible that the viral load, along with the variant's ability to infect other cells or other people, quickly drops as it attempts to spread beyond the upper airways or as it encounters interferon. Omicron is very good at getting into cells of the nose, Berkeley says, adding, once it's in there, actually, I don't think that Omicron is a terribly fit virus. The diminished severity has provided a thin silver lining to the Omicron surge, but most experts think this won't be the final variant of concern. There are two likely scenarios going forward, says Jess Bloom, an evolutionary virologist at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research in Seattle, Washington. One is that Omicron continues to evolve, creating some sort of Omicron plus variant that is worse than BA1 or BA2. The other possibility is that a new, unrelated variant appears. The latter is what's happened with each variant of concern so far. With dozens of mutations, Omicron explored more of the evolutionary space than the other variants. Many of Omicron's mutations ought to make it less fit, but it thrives, probably because other mutations mitigate those disadvantages. Researchers can also put pressure on the virus in the lab, allowing it to evolve in the presence of antibodies or antiviral drugs. For example, scientists passed an early SARS-CoV-2 strain from dish to dish in the presence of the antiviral remdesivir, and the virus readily developed a mutation that made it less sensitive to the drug. These kinds of experiments enable researchers to predict how the virus might evolve. Finding such mutations in the lab doesn't mean they will occur in nature, but scientists tracking coronavirus genetics through surveillance can keep an eye out for them. SARS-CoV-2 is known to infect several animal species, including mink, deer, and hamsters. Some scientists think that Omicron could have passed through an animal host to host before it was first detected in South Africa last November. Other researchers are wondering whether it might infiltrate even more species than it is known to and then move back to humans again, potentially bringing new and dangerous adaptations. As for severity, there is no guarantee that it will continue to diminish. Chan is keeping an eye on pathogenicity using the virus temperature preference as a clue. Viruses that stick to the upper airway replicate well at a cool 33 degrees Celsius and tend to cause a milder infection. Those that prefer the 37 degrees Celsius of the lungs are likely to be more virulent. The original Omicron variant doesn't seem to grow better at either temperature. Whatever happens next, these and other questions will keep scientists busy with Omicron for months to come. Most current research is still preliminary, awaiting peer review and confrontation in other labs. After all, researchers were still trying to understand Delta when Omicron emerged, notes a scientist, adding, "We've only really known this variant since the end of November. We don't know a lot yet."
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the position of housing in Islamic culture. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of the position of housing in Islamic culture. We know that Islam says that if someone needs a house, it is necessary to him to have a house. And initially, in the early time in the Islam, we can see that whenever a couple used to marry, like a man or a woman, when they used to marry, the other people or the neighbors or the parents, they used to help them in making a house separately if they needed that. So the people, they were all helping each other, and they used to manage to make a house or build a house for this new couple. And therefore, Islam also emphasizes on such thing. On the other hand, we can see that in today's world, we have a lot of issues. For example, the people where they are hungry, they do not have anything to eat, they are facing the thirst, they are facing the, the being hunger, they are facing the hardship in their life. And on top of that, there is another issue, which is the rent. And they are forced, obviously, according to today's system, according to this capitalist system that we have today in this world, the people, they are obviously, they have to pay this rent in order to have a proper place to live, which shouldn't be this way because it is the capitalist system. In the capitalism, the person who owns the house is earning through any means he wants, and there is no idea of charity or helping people or the social life. Therefore, people, general people, are suffering from such ideas. Well, Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the position of housing in Islamic culture. And we said that, unfortunately, in today's world, due to the system which is running the whole world, which is known as capitalism, due to that, people are suffering from the housing issues. They do not have house. They have to pay heavy rents. And on top of that, the houses are not according to their needs. So they are only getting the house which they can basically, they can pay off, or they can pay the rent, which they can pay its rent. That is the criteria of choosing a house in today's world. And it is not according to the needs of the person. So we need to look at the Islamic teachings, because Islamic teaching says that this house which you need to live according to the Islamic teachings, where you can follow your religion, where you can have peace and happiness in your life, it should be in a way that it should be enough for you. And on top of that, it should have some place for you to enjoy your life. So therefore, when we look at the Islamic point of view of choosing a house, Islam emphasizes on this. But on the other hand, Islam also stops us from oppressing someone. So we need to help. We have infaq in the religion. We have this feeling of helping others in the religion, and the rewards are near Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So we need to help each other in order to provide a better house, a shelter for the others as well, inshallah. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
James Dyke, Assistant Director of the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter, Southwest England, said, "It's hard to believe that Elsevier, a Dutch company that publishes research about the dangers of the climate and ecological crises, is the very same company that actively works with oil and gas companies to extract more fossil fuels, which drags us towards disaster. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Amy Westworld titled, Revealed, Leading Climate Research Publisher Helps Fuel Oil and Gas Drilling. Please stay with us to hear more about this story. The Guardian can reveal scientists working with one of the world's largest climate research publishers say they're increasingly alarmed that the company works with the fossil fuel industry to help increase oil and gas drilling. Elsevier, a Dutch company behind many renowned peer-reviewed scientific journals, including The Lancet and Global Environmental Change, is also one of the top publishers of books aimed at expanding fossil fuel production. For more than a decade, the company has supported the energy industry's efforts to optimize oil and gas extraction. It commissions authors, editors, and journal advisory board members who are employees at top oil firms. Elsevier also markets some of its research portals and data services directly to the oil and gas industry to help increase the odds of exploration success. Several former and current employees say that for the past year, dozens of workers have spoken out internally and at company-wide town halls to urge Elsevier to reconsider its relationship with the fossil fuel industry. A former Elsevier Journal editor who agreed to speak on condition of anonymity said, "When I first started, I heard a lot about the company's climate commitments," adding, "Eventually, I just realized it was all marketing, which is really upsetting because Elsevier has published all the research it needs to know exactly what to do if it wants to make a meaningful difference." What makes Elsevier ties to the fossil fuel industry particularly alarming to its critics is that it is one of the handful of companies that publish peer-reviewed climate research. Scientists and academics say they are concerned that Elsevier's conflicting business interests risk undermining their work. Julia Steinberger, a social ecologist and ecological economist at Université de Lausanne, who has published studies in several Elsevier journals, said she was shocked to hear that the company took an active role in expanding fossil fuel extraction. She said Elsevier is the publisher of some of the most important journals in the environmental space, adding, "They cannot claim ignorance of the facts of climate change and the urgent necessity to move away from fossil fuels." She added, "Their business model seems to be to profit from publishing climate and energy science, while disregarding the most basic fact of climate action, the urgent need to move away from fossil fuels." Elsevier and its parent company, RELS, say they are committed to supporting the fossil fuel industry as it transitions towards clean energy. And while Elsevier has emerged as an industry leader with its own climate pledges, a spokesperson for the company said they're not prepared to draw a line between the transition away from fossil fuels and the expansion of oil and gas extraction. She voiced concern about publishers boycotting or canceling oil and gas firms. Marcia Bassiano, founding global head of corporate responsibility at RELS, told The Guardian, "We recognize that we are imperfect and we have to do more, but that shouldn't negate all of the amazing work we have done over the past 15 years. Of the more than 2,000 scholarly journals that Elsevier publishes, only 7 are specific to fossil fuel extraction. Those journals include Upstream Oil and Gas Technology, the editor-in-chief of which works for Shell, and Unconventional Resources, which is edited by a Chevron researcher. It also runs a subsidiary book publishing, which includes titles such as The Shale Oil and Gas Handbook and a strategy for optimizing petroleum exploration." Elsevier also provides consultancy services to corporate clients. For the past 12 years, it has marketed a tool called GeoFacets to fossil fuel companies. GeoFacets combines thousands of maps and studies to make it easier to find and access oil and gas reserves. In addition to locations for wind farms or carbon storage facilities, the company claims the tool cuts research time by 50% and helps identify riskier, more remote areas that had previously been inaccessible. However, top climate scientists, including those published in Elsevier's own journal, say just the opposite must happen in order to avert a climate catastrophe. Limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius or less requires a worldwide decrease in fossil fuel production, with more than 80% of all proven reserves left in the ground. Sherry Aldis, the deputy director for UN Department of Global Communication, said, "We will not comment on the practices of individual companies, but any actions actively supporting the expansion of fossil fuel development are indeed inconsistent with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals." RELX is an astoundingly profitable company with annual revenues topping $9.8 billion, about a third of which are brought in by Elsevier. Masiano emphasizes that fossil fuel content represents less than 1% of Elsevier's publishing revenue, and less than half of Geofacet's revenue, which itself represents only about 2% of Elsevier's earnings. RELX and Elsevier say the bulk of their work supports and enables an energy transition via publications centered on clean energy. Esra Erkal, Executive Vice President of Communications at Elsevier, claimed, "We don't want to draw a binary, and we don't think you can just flip a switch, but we have been reducing our involvement with fossil fuel activities while increasing the amount of research we publish on climate and clean energy." Elsevier is not alone in navigating relationships with both climate researchers and fossil fuel executives. Multiple other publishers of peer-reviewed climate research have signed on to the UN Sustainable Development Goals Publishers Compact, while also partnering with the oil and gas industry in various ways. For example, the UK-based publisher Taylor & Francis signed the UN pledge and released its own net zero commitments, while also touting its publishing partnership with industry leader ExxonMobil, the oil company most linked to obstructionism on climate in the public conscientious. Another top climate publisher, Willy, also signed on to the Sustainability Compact while publishing multiple books and journals aimed at helping the industry find and drill for more oil and gas. Dr. Kimberly Nicholas, Associate Professor of Sustainability Science at Lund University in Sweden, said, "It's problematic," noting that while corporate greenwashing is rampant across multiple industries, the publishers of peer-reviewed climate research have a unique responsibility. She said, "If the same publisher putting out the papers that show definitively we can't burn any more fossil fuels and stay within this carbon budget is also helping this fossil fuel industry do just that, what does that to do the whole premise of validity around the climate research? That is what's deeply concerning about these conflicts." Ben Franta, a researcher at Stanford University who has also published the studies in Elsevier journals, notes that the publisher's relationship with oil firms is indicative of just how entwined that industry is with so many other aspects of society. He said, "This all happens without the broader public knowing, and it operates to entrench the industry," adding, "To effect a rapid replacement of fossil fuels, I believe these entanglements will need to be exposed and reformed." For its part, Elsevier emphasizes the role of editorial independence. Bassiano said, "We wouldn't want to tell journal editors what they can and can't publish. However, such conflicts often place researchers in a tough position to navigate." James Dock, assistant director of the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter, was surprised that Elsevier would be working to contradict climate researchers in this way. He said, "It's hard to believe that a company that publishes research about the dangers of the climate and ecological crisis is the very same company that actively works with oil and gas companies to extract more fossil fuels, which drags us towards disaster."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
Today, the media network are tools and instruments for cultural infiltration. Today, they are the enemy's tools for cultural domination. And to say it briefly, economic independence is the refusal to be digested into the stomach of the global economy. Notice that they, the Americans, said after the nuclear negotiations that the nuclear deal should cause Iran's economy to merge with the global economy. Merge? What does merging mean? What is the global economy? Is the global economy a fair, reasonable, and rational system? Not at all. An economy whose plan has been formulated by the Global Committee and whose various branches are spread throughout the world is a plan and system that has been devised mainly by Zionists, capitalists, and some non-Zionists with the purpose of usurping the economic resources of the entire world. This is the order system of the global community and the global economy. If a country merges its economy with the global economy, this is not a source of pride. Rather, it is a loss and a defeat.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
During the time of sanctions, too, they had an economic goal. When sanctions were imposed on us, the Americans stated that the purpose of sanctions is to cripple the economy of Iran. Now that the nuclear negotiations have been conducted, certain results have been produced. Here, too, they pursue an economic goal. One of their goals is to target our economy. They want to swallow Iran's economy through the stomach of the international and global economy headed by America. Economic independence is achieved only through an economy of resistance. We name this year the Year of the Economy of Resistance, Action and Implementation. Fortunately, the Honorable Administration has begun action and implementation. According to the report that they have delivered to me, the good tasks have been carried out. If it continues with the same strength and methods, and if it moves forward with the same seriousness, the people will undoubtedly witness those results. This is the economy of resistance. All great economic decisions should be defined on the basis of the economy of resistance.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashabit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
After months of suspension, Afghan public universities have reopened. We visited Kabul University and spoke with a number of teachers and students. They say they are happy returning to the campus and hope good educational days are ahead.
We are very happy that we have returned to university again. We have been away from our classes and lessons for almost 7 months. I was longing for this day so much. This new beginning and opportunity can motivate us and give more hope for the future.
It is a big day for the young generation. The opening of the doors of universities could open the doors of developments. I hope this process continues well. I urge the international community to help our higher education sector and poor families so that their sons and daughters can get education.
Male and female students are returning to Kabul University, but in different shifts. Moreover, new roles and changes are brought by the new directors.
Actually, I witnessed a lot of changes in Kabul University. First, some departments in the fine art faculty like cinema, music, and theater are said to be cancelled. Secondly, students are obliged to change their outfits. Girls should come in the morning and boys in the afternoon. In addition, we didn't find most of our former teachers and there were new figures.
Some experts say it's not all about reopening, and there are many challenges left on the way of higher education in Afghanistan.
A huge number of our scholars, professors, and lecturers left our country during the government change. This has caused a significant loss in our higher education institutions. We need them back now. Furthermore, the Taliban government are going to make changes in universities' educational syllabuses and staff. It's uncertain whether the Taliban are leading our higher education.
Like most public universities, Kabul University had closed in the immediate aftermath of the Taliban took over. Formerly, the university had remained shut for some months due to COVID-19 pandemic. The reopening of universities have brought hope to the younger generation in Afghanistan. Students here say this process must be supported in advance so that they can continue their education this year successfully. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iran's parliament is reviewing the details of the budget bill for the next fiscal year, starting on March 21st. The government's proposed budget stands at roughly $148 billion, some 4% higher than last year's approved budget. Lawmakers have earlier approved the generalities of the budget bill, and it's been a week now since the thorough examination of the bill kicked off in parliament's open sessions.
The government's cap on next year's budget is roughly $148 billion. Out of this figure, $60 billion is allocated for the general budget and $88 billion is earmarked for government spending. Parliament is making some revisions, especially in national development projects and infrastructure. We increased the allocated budget in these areas.
This time, the budget's examination process took longer due to the fact that lawmakers want to be as meticulous as possible while evaluating the income and spending in the country.
While Iran and the P4 Plus One are engaged in tough negotiations in Vienna over the revival of the 2015 deal, President Ebrahim Raisi says the budget bill seeks to promote a resistance economy that would not need to wait for the removal of U.S. sanctions.
Parliament says the budget bill was drawn up based on a no-deal possibility in the Vienna talks and the continuation of U.S. sanctions on Iran.
The proposed budget expects the country's oil sales to reach 1.2 million barrels per day, with $60 a barrel, which would earn Iran some $14 billion in the fiscal year 2022-23. Lawmakers reset this figure to 1.4 million BPDs, with $70 a barrel. Any agreement in the ongoing Vienna talks will immediately push Iran's oil sales up by at least 500,000 BPDs as a result of the removal of U.S. oil embargoes on Iran. But lawmakers say they will not wait for the fate of the negotiations to finalize their budget bill, saying any extra petrodollar will be spent for the good of the people.
We cannot waste our time and wait if the U.S. removes the sanctions or not. So we set the budget based on a daily export of 1.4 million barrels of oil through direct or barter sales, and based on assumptions that oil prices will hover around $70, when in fact the prices are reaching $100. Any extra oil income will be saved in the National Development Fund.
President Ibrahim Raisi submitted the budget bill to Parliament in mid-December last year, when Parliament approved its general outlines. Lawmakers now have 3 weeks to go over the details and fix the shortcomings of the budget, to pass it into law, before handing it to the higher legislative body, the Constitutional Council, for final approval. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
EU foreign affairs ministers held talks in Brussels to bolster the 27-nation bloc's second round of new sanctions against Russia over the Kremlin's military campaign in Ukraine.
Only leaders in the world who are sanctioned by the European Union, Assad from Syria, Lukashenko from Belarus, and now Putin from Russia.
Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has also been added to the sanctions list. The idea is to block banks in the EU from making funds available to the two key Russian figures. Earlier on Friday, EU leaders agreed sanctions on Russia's energy, aviation and financial sectors.
We're now targeting 70% of the Russian banking market, but also key state-owned companies, including the field of defence.
Outside the EU leaders' summit, union members staged a peace demonstration.
We don't think to have a war in Ukraine is a good thing for European workers and for Ukrainian workers. So we don't agree with the war.
Leaders from the 30-country NATO alliance held a summit on Friday. The big question is, could moves by the West stoke the flames and turn this crisis into a catastrophe?
NATO allies have and continue to provide support, military, but also different types of equipment to Ukraine.
US troops under the NATO flag have just arrived in Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania. Moscow had requested less provocation from NATO, but it appears those calls continue to fall on deaf ears. According to some analysts, one positive fallout from the crisis could be greater independence for the EU when it comes to foreign policy. The point has been made, there will be a realisation in the coming months. It is dangerous and extremely costly economically to allow Washington dictate relations between neighbours on the other side of the Atlantic. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
At tea break, young girls working at the Central Market in the heart of New Delhi. They say things have changed significantly since the December 2012 gang rape. Now the streets of Delhi are safer for women, as we can see the change. But more needs to be done, considering the population of the city. These working girls are excited to see the new pink booth launched by the Delhi police to make the city safer for girls and women.
Women are more secure nowadays. Police helpline number we are given, and I think last week they have opened several pink police booth in local market near places where we can directly complain women have.
Although the initiative started a week ago, the drive is gaining a gradual popularity across the city. The booths are staffed with all women police officers filing complaints on the spot, mainly in the crowded markets, besides helping female commuters with any sort of problems they face while shopping. The initiative has received an overwhelming response from citizens, especially on the social media. Now calls are growing across the country for similar booths for women and girls in distress, since the office provides them with the on-spot help. Indian women live in a constant barrage of threats ranging from rape, torture, abduction, stalking, domestic violence, dowry deaths and other forms of violence. The administration in recent years adopted a string of stringent measures as a result of law.